Hello and welcome back to Enterprise Linux Security, this time episode number 88. How you doing, Zhao?
All good. All good, Jay. As always, a pleasure being here with you. Sorry, I was just stopping the video on the other screen. a pleasure being here with you for another episode, 88. My God, how time flies. We have yet another report that we are going to take a look at today. The reason why we focus so much on these reports, and I know some people don't like them particularly, but it's that it's really tricky to have a snapshot of the industry as a whole, and these reports will give you a point-in-time idea of how things are moving. Specifically, this one from Verizon has a lot of data points and has some interesting findings. Again, we're going to cover lots of different stuff that they covered in the report, and also an article that describes some nuances about the data. And go ahead. I'm sure you have more information on that.
Yeah. Oh, I do. But before we get started, I want to also just take care of a little bit of errata. So, or miscellany, I should say. So apologies for the erratic schedule. I'm still in the middle of the LPI course just to kind of give everyone an update. It's just going a little longer than I thought, but I just wanted to let everyone know things will be more stable once I get that done. It's days away at this point. So it's for Linux Essentials, LPI Linux Essentials. It's a Udemy course I'm working on. So just wanted to mention that it's coming. Go to learnlinux.tv. I'll post something about it there when it's done, probably within this week, most likely, if everything keeps going according to plan. So apologies for that, but hope everyone enjoys the course. And I also wanted to mention that the merchandise shop was updated. If anyone wants to buy an Enterprise Linux Security shirt, you'll find it there, among other things. And what we're going to do today, like Zhao said, is we're going to discuss the, I don't want to say DBIR or DBIR. This acronym stands for the Verizon's Data Breach Investigations Report. So I'll just say from now on, the report. So it's 100 pages, basically, as you were saying, and it goes through some information that I think it's always a hit or miss. Something is either going to surprise you or it's not. So some of this is going to be completely unsurprising, like 93% of the breaches are financially motivated. I mean, that's not a surprise to me, and I don't think very many other people. But there are some findings in here, and we'll have some links to the actual article, which is gated, but we'll have another article from Kelly Shortridge that we will link that has her commentary, great article. And what we're going to do now is unpack this and take some nuggets out of this and see what we can glean from it.
Okay, so the first thing that I mentioned right off on the summary of findings is the ways in analysis. Basically, it's the most common attack vectors that were used on the incidents covered in the report. And surprisingly, I would say almost 40% of the breaches involved some form of credential theft or credential brute forcing or stuffing, which is basically, rather than trying all the combinations of passwords, you just pick the lists off the internet and reuse the ones that you already know are being used somewhere and try them against a different target. Next one, again, also unsurprisingly, is phishing. People just love clicking on email links, and people will always love clicking on email links. And further along the report, we'll go into more detail on why people love clicking on those email links, and that might be a bit more surprising. And the last on the top three of the attack vectors is vulnerability exploits. This one is more surprising than it would be expected. It rose 180% from the year previous. It stands at around 18% of all data, of all the security breaches, starting from a vulnerability being exploited. And it doesn't really have to be OData vulnerabilities, even if some of them are. But people are still not patching fast enough to respond to this. They have more information on why that fast enough is really not fast enough, and we'll get into that as well. But it's still surprising to see something that's relatively easily fixable on the top three. And when I say easily fixable, it's easier to patch systems than to patch people.
You are absolutely correct there. The user error side of things is, you know, it's not surprising, but there's a surprising aspect here. It's, we kind of expect this because we, at least I've been through this. I've seen people delete things they didn't mean to delete, and sometimes entire company volumes get, you know, hosed because someone deleted the wrong thing, or, you know, the employee is upset or something, and these things happen. But in this report, it's basically showing some other sides of this that I don't think about, like someone sending an email to an unintended recipient. So here you have someone who just fat fingers something in their contact list and sends some kind of information to someone that shouldn't have received it. You know, that's going to be part of it as well. And that's going to be there. And then, of course, the report also talks about employees that take their company contacts with them, or confidential information with them as they leave. I mean, we always want to think about people using a vulnerability to get into something, but this report several times has examples that people are just going to go towards the lowest common denominator, which MoveIt was used in the report as an example of that, because it's going to have some stuff in there. Its point is to move files. And if threat actors want files, how about they go to the thing where the files are, right?
Yeah, and we might as well just discuss that right now. They mentioned on the report that MoveIt was selected as a prime example and merits its own category in the report as well, because there's this difference between an attacker going after a MoveIt target than going after a random server inside of an organization. The difference being that for any given server, they are not sure of what they are going to find in there. They're not sure if it's going to be worth the time and the effort of getting into that system. Going after a MoveIt volume or a MoveIt share or something similar means that what information is present on that share, whatever information is there, is already something that they know is valuable, or else it wouldn't be shared or stored in that volume. So it's the difference in perceived value of the attack. Why should I waste my time going after an uncertain target when I know for sure that this target is valuable? And this means that the different vulnerabilities that were found on MoveIt last year made a significant impact in this report and made it a significant impact on the number of breaches overall.
When I read part of this, I thought about the when a CTO reads these white papers or whatever, the advertisement for this security app or this file storage app with all the bullet points, you know, return on investment, easy to install, whatever, has all these things and features. I almost wonder if like threat actors are on the other side of this, putting their fake CTO hat, this software features file storage and this and that. We need to get some files. We need some contact information. And this thing stores that. Obviously, it's MoveIt is for files. My point being that sometimes I wonder, you know, the highlight of a software is just also the same thing that a threat actor is going to go after it for, because storage absolutely is going to be a big target.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the most important stuff that you have in your company, regardless of the company, regardless of what industry you're in, it's always going to be the data. We've moved into an economic situation where data is the most valuable asset that you can have in a company. And everybody knows it at this point. So the threat actors know it as well. And that's what they're going to be targeting. About a third of all the breaches involved ransomware and or extortion. So it's either ransomware, extortion, each one of them alone, or both covered together. We've covered multiple examples of this. We covered the story with the Las Vegas casinos, we covered Change Healthcare, we covered several other stories related to this. And it's notable that ransomware alone has dropped slightly, as extortion alone has started to climb and make up for that loss. So attackers are now seeing extortion as a more easy pass towards monetization. It's not the effort of deploying software on other systems and getting that software to run on a compromised system. They're basically just getting all the data off, siphoning everything off to their own servers, and then then asking for money not to release that data. Personally, I believe it's a lack of effort in their part, because if they can get the same result with less effort, I mean, why would they do that?
Yeah, contrary to popular belief, I don't think hackers are always out for bragging rights, although maybe a lot of them are, but not, at least not to the point where they're creating more work for themselves. The shortest path of least resistance will always be the most attractive when someone wants a piece of information.
So, of all the breaches, 68% involve the human element. This is not just stuff like leaking an email link. This is also stuff like making a mistake, sending data to the wrong recipient, those kinds of things that humans really make their mistakes in. It doesn't have to be intentional. It doesn't have to be a malevolent insider, a malicious insider doing nasty things inside of your organization. It can just be accidental, but it still leads to data being exfiltrated in the wrong way and still leads into your information ending up in the wrong situation. Another third of these problems involved errors in configurations, in deployments, errors in not securing the stuff that you deploy properly, not following the guidelines, that kind of things. And about 15%, and I know the percentages here add to more than 100%, but it's because some incidents suffer from multiple of these things. 15% involve the third party, meaning that it could be a service provider, it could be your cloud provider, for example, or it could be supply chain problems, meaning that the library that you use on an application that's running inside of your organization or something that you develop internally is made vulnerable through a third party. Again, we covered all of these things previously on the podcast.
So how much time do you spend looking at emails when you see one?
Probably a bit more than 2 seconds, and I know where you're going with that.
You sure do, because the median time apparently for users to fall for phishing emails is less than 60 seconds. And Kelly quotes, "I do not understand what's alarming about this. It feels very unsurprising. Who is spending more than a minute scrutinizing emails?" And, you know, that's one of the reasons why I like this article so much. But, you know, email has been one of these things where we went from, like, being excited to receive an email to not being excited about it to hating it because it's been a security risk. But when it comes to people clicking links, yeah, she mentioned some numbers. But the part that I wanted to, that I never even really thought of, is that it's not really rational to expect people not to click links. You give them a mouse. It has a button, and it's made to click things. And when people tell you how to do things, they tell you to click things. But don't click that thing. That one link is in the email is bad, but that password reset email is fine, but not that one. That one's shady. You know, this it's really hard for people to navigate. But as Kelly said, and as she quotes, "We have utterly failed as an industry if our hope rests on humans not clicking things on the thing-clicking machine."
Okay, so...
And I love that.
Yeah, the quote is really good. So according to her, and this is outside of the report, but it's on the article talking about the report, people spend on average 2 seconds per email. Let that sink in for a bit. Within those 2 seconds, your brain will have to identify the sender, understand if you know the sender or not, identify the goal of the email, locate any key information in the email, and identify the call to action. Is there something that you need to click? Is there something that you need to respond to? What do you need to do with that email? And then you move to the next email. And then 2 more seconds of attention to get all of those details. So expecting people to make all the right decisions on every single email, it's, again, not feasible. It's impossible to expect that. I don't know. I'm sure I'm not the person who receives the most emails in the world, and I absolutely... I'm not, but I still manage to get several dozen a day. Most of them work-related, and I'm not even counting stuff from newsletters and the like. But I receive several dozen emails per day. I'm sure I give them more than 2 seconds attention, but I don't give them a minute each by any measure. And at some point, it's very easy to get 100 emails, especially if you're, say, in support and you're flooded with tickets one day. It's really easy to get 100 email notifications in one day. If you spend 4 or 5 minutes on each one, that's your entire workday. It's impossible to do that. So at some point, people need to manage the expectations of why are people clicking on phishing emails when it's so obviously a phishing email, with the amount of emails that people need to vet every single time. And at some point, everybody makes mistakes. And yeah, you click the accidental link and now you fall for a phishing scam.
But how many times are we going to have to tell people not to click on links before generally people don't, because I almost feel like there's this expectation that, you know, like the year of the Linux desktop, we're going to hit a point where Linux desktops take over. Now we're going to hit a point where people stop clicking on Linux or links in email, right? When is that day coming? Because we've been trying to tell people this for a very long time, and it just doesn't seem to be working. So it's, in my mind, it's like, it's not working. It's like we're losing the fight. And the article in the numbers definitely show that, because, and we don't need a report to know that people are impulsive. So it's just a fight that I feel like we have to fight it differently. It's just not working. People they keep clicking on things.
Absolutely. And those 2 seconds, it's on average per email. Of course, you're going to skim through, I don't know, the spam stuff that gets past your filter. You're going to notice that it's spam and you're moving to the next, and that will skew the average there. But when something draws your attention to a particular email, you will spend a few seconds longer. The median time to click on a malicious link, and this is on the report, is 21 seconds. Okay, still a ridiculously low amount of time. And another 28 seconds later, you have already entered your personal information on the form that pops up on the scam site. So it's less than a minute since you receive and open the email until you've fallen for the scam. That's really scary, but it's also really difficult to protect against effectively. It's a people problem. It's not a technological problem. There's no amount of firewalls and emails, spam protections and security that you can put in place that catches all of them, and all it takes is one. But it's a ridiculously low amount of time. And they got this in the report, and they have more information on how they came to these numbers. It was surprising to me that it would be less than a minute for the whole scam to take place and for your information to be moved somewhere else.
Yeah, I get it. It's just email is one of those things that, you know, I don't think anyone really loves it anymore. You know, it's just, we used to really think it was great in the early days, and now it's just a threat actor avenue in general. And I don't know what to do anymore. I feel like we just need to look at the industry and try to solve things differently. But until then, education is the only thing we could do. And we're just going to keep everyone to just, you know, scrutinize everything, even though most people don't. You should be.
With the caveat that you will fall into that seconds problem there that Kelly mentioned on her article, you're going to be teaching people how to handle that. And that means that people will be slower at analyzing the emails. And that means people will take longer at looking at each email, and there's not enough time to do that. We concern ourselves with the professional emails use case, obviously. But there's another factor. You can be targeted on your personal emails, and through compromising your personal systems, they might have a jump point through your corporate infrastructure if you have a VPN installed or something like that. But again, it's not really a technological problem that can be solved through new software or improved software or something like that. It has to have both parts of the equation. You need to have the proper tools in place to catch the majority of it, and you have to have the people aware enough not to fall for these things and trained to do that really quickly so as not to delay their workflow so much that it's infeasible.
Another aspect of it, I thought it was interesting that Kelly brought this up. The report claims that 7% of breaches are espionage related. And I think we touched on that earlier. But the thing that I thought was interesting is the comment where she says, the ones motivated by geopolitical power do not think about you at all. Now, before I, you know, go into that a little bit more, I want to be careful, because there very well could be people that work in government listening to this podcast. So I'm by no means telling anyone to, you know, assume something isn't important. But when you have people claiming insert name of government here is trying to hack me, I hear this all the time, but the numbers just don't show it. Ones that are in, you know, doing the espionage essentially with this, they just don't seem to be as big of a target as we thought they were yet. It's something people are constantly afraid of.
I think we need to delve a bit more on that. I don't completely agree with what Kelly wrote there on her analysis. there's different goals for a state-sponsored attacker than it is from, say, your run-of-the-mill ransomware gang. The ransomware gang is trying to make a quick buck and get away really quickly. They're just trying to get your money and out, and that's it. A state-sponsored attacker, and we all know the stories. We all know that North Koreans love to hack companies and then extort them for money because they desperately need the funds. And that's true, and that's been documented, and that's happened over the past few years, and we know that that continues to happen. But the majority of state-sponsored stuff, at least the one from the examples that we've seen so far, they're not in it to make money. They're not in it to make a quick buck. They're not in it to stop systems immediately. They're in it for the long haul. As we've seen on the XZ debacle that we've discussed a couple of episodes ago, their goal was to infiltrate basically any single Linux system out there, deployed or to be deployed. They didn't care what type of company you were on. They didn't care if you were important enough to be a target or not. They were targeting every single system, regardless of where they were, regardless if it was a personal system or if it was an enterprise system. But every single one would be compromised. And that would be the ultimate goal for them. Had they not been caught when they were, that's what would have happened. And in all likelihood, they're very much state-sponsored. That was a state-sponsored operation that ran for over 2 years. If that's the example that we have of something that was caught, we can assume or we can reasonably expect that other types of operations on that scale have the same mindset. They're just trying to get into systems and remain there unseen. Probably siphon data off, but basically they don't want to get caught as quickly as that.
So they're on a very specific mission. Very specific mission.
There are different ways that you can look at that small percentage. Either that small percentage represents the cases where they tried to go after a specific target and they were caught doing that, or it was the situations where they were reckless or acted too hastily or something like that. But it might represent a small percentage simply because the other ones weren't caught. The level of sophistication we saw with the XC1, it would be almost impossible to cut, even if you were deliberately looking for it. Please remember that.
Yeah, I mean, after all, if the espionage is perfect, then how do you know that they're even there in the first place to give them a count? So that's a very good point.
I know Kelly makes an argument about, yeah, you're just crying wolf all the time and the sky is falling and all of that, and yeah, nobody's going after you because your company is so small. Yeah, they're going after everybody. It doesn't matter if it's you particularly. They're not targeting you particularly. Your systems just get caught up in the net. Again, I would take with a pinch of salt that small percentage there, because it might not actually be representative of the risk associated with that. At the risk of myself sounding like the guy crying wolf all the time.
I guess at one point it's humorous when you have people claiming something and the numbers don't line up. But I guess the problem I have myself is that I'll never tell somebody not to check into something if they think something's not going right when it comes to security. So to say that, you know, people with geopolitical power do not care about you at all when they don't know what you do or what your company does, it's kind of assumptive, I would think, too. So we got to be careful. Although it's a little humorous with telling people not to care about something, and then all of a sudden something happens because they were told not to care about it. So,
I mean, it shouldn't ruin your day planning against it, but you shouldn't just brush it aside entirely. You should make some assumption of risk that there's this small percentage of things that can happen that are just not financially motivated. Especially if you're operating on specific industries, you're obviously more of a target if you're in specific industries, and everybody knows which ones I'm mentioning. But again, for example, the Change Healthcare incident. Their position in the healthcare industry was so critical that going after them meant that it affected millions of patients and millions of users of the healthcare system in the US. That's critical infrastructure. Should they be worried about foreign governments trying to get into their systems? Most definitely they should. And they're not operating in the typically industries associated with, say, warfare or something like that. They're just critical infrastructure. It depends a lot. It's not something that you can make a blanket statement saying, oh, I'll never be targeted by a state-sponsored attacker, just because that's ridiculous and that's completely out of this world to expect that. It might happen.
Yeah, I mean, you do have a good point. It's definitely, you should never count anything out.
One thing that I would also like to cover, and again, this touches again on ransomware. It's the most prevalent attack form, and it's the most prevalent attack form mentioned in the report. It's the financial aspect of it. As you mentioned at the start, 93% of the attacks are financially motivated. Absolutely. That's the great incentive for attackers to do something, is to extract some money from it. But it's also relevant that we mention a number that they have in the report. 96% of all the ransomware incidents involved no cost. Let that sink in for a second. Nobody suffered any losses in 96% of the ransomware incidents that happened and were reported. That means that no ransom was paid, they didn't experience other financial losses, or at least they didn't admit to them. And that means that the majority of ransomware incidents basically resulted in no losses for the victims. That's really important. However, the other 4% include everything from really small payouts to the big millions of dollars payouts that we've discussed previously on the podcast. So just because the percentage where nothing happened is really large, that small percentage of incidents where it did cost money, it cost a lot of money. Really a lot of money. So, yeah.
It's interesting to look at that. Yeah, I mean, yeah, so basically 4 out of 100 would pay. I mean, that's like, I mean, you could have 4 out of 100 sales leads pay off for a sales rep, and if the value is right, they might be able to make a living on it. I mean, it's kind of strange to try to put a number on it, and it's great that some people aren't paying the ransom, but at the same time, 4%, like you're saying, could be a very large number. So it's kind of depends on how you look at it.
So they have over 1,000 reported incidents covered on the report. 63% of those involved ransomware, and then of those 63%, only 4% involved some type of financial loss. It's still a number, it's still considerable, but that accounts for a lot of money. The median loss on those 4% was $46,000. Not much, but it counts for everything from a $3 loss, I don't know who reported a $3 loss, but apparently someone did, to over $1 million. And that's for 95% of those 4%. Just on the other 5%, go for all the big names that you've heard on the news. Okay, and there were quite a lot of them last year. There were the Las Vegas casinos was a very big one. It had a really costly impact, lots of days without the casinos operating. There was payment of ransom involved. There was a lot of money exchanging hands those days. But that wasn't by any measure the only one. There were some other incidents, some high-profile incidents that we also covered last year. And while a very tiny percentage amounted to all of that, again, it's a considerable amount of money. This does play into something, and Kelly points this out on her article. Should you make efforts into a very costly ransomware prevention solution, or should you just expect to have that level of cost over a year? $46,000 cost might not be that much for most companies, and would be cheaper than getting a ransomware protection solution that would cost you more in licensing, for example. She weighs those differences there. She weighs those options, not doing it versus the potential cost that might take. Again, take it with a grain of salt, because there's no assurance that you're going to be hit by the median value. These types of statistical analysis, they always hide a lot of the details. It's like the average. You might have this weird average, and none of the values in it are the actual average, so it doesn't really represent much. And the median suffers from something similar. But again, CIOs might look at an article like hers and they might get the wrong idea as well. So take it with a pinch of salt.
At least it can start a dialogue, which is always a good thing.
There is also something interesting. Basically, the whole report is based on the premise of reported incidents, the whole Verizon report. And this is something that happens because reporting this type of incidents is now mandatory. And that's really relevant. And it gives transparency and it also gives us this insight into the state of the industry. And it's really interesting that we're having more data about this type of incidents because we didn't have it before. And we were operating basically blind. We didn't exactly know the scope of the challenges that we were facing. We didn't know how much it cost. We didn't know what type of infrastructure was being attacked or not, because companies would keep that information to themselves and not release it. Now they're obligated to do that, and that is really good for everybody else.
I definitely agree with that, because I could definitely make the numbers more accurate, which will never be completely accurate for the reasons you mentioned, but that definitely will help.
Yeah, there is one thing more that I want to cover. They mentioned vulnerabilities being exploited as the main way, one of the three main ways on how you get ransomware into your systems. And then they have this nice graph that mentions four of the vulnerabilities that are present in the CISA list of known exploited vulnerabilities. They have how long it takes for them to be patched inside of an organization. And I mean, at TaxCare, it's what we do. We provide patches for vulnerabilities. So this was especially relevant to me. 30 days after a vulnerability has a patch available, 85% are still unpatched. 55 days after you have the patch available, 50% are still unpatched. 180 days, half a year, 20% are still unpatched. 1 year after the patch is available, 8% of the vulnerabilities are still unpatched. If you're looking for reasons why you got ransomware on your servers, this is why. Okay, you don't need to start pointing fingers, you don't need to look behind the door to see if someone's there. This is why you need to patch your systems. If there's any more flagrant reason, more blatant reason why you need patching and you need to patch faster, this is why. You cannot take 30 days to patch a known vulnerability and expect your systems to be secure. They're no longer your systems. They're just in your data center. Yeah, do take a look at the report. This is really important. You need to internalize this information. You need to patch your systems, and you need to patch them as soon as possible.
I want to underscore that, because what I don't like is when someone gets information like this and they read it, oh, that's nice, and they put it down and they go about their day. You know, we all understand, at least if you've been listening to this podcast for a while and if you're not new to the industry, we understand what we have to do. If we get it, right? But we have to do it. And a lot of times it could be someone else that doesn't allow us to do it or some kind of boundary there. But if we keep reading and digesting reports, and all we do is read and digest reports, so we don't turn that into some kind of action, we're just going to be reading the same reports again and again and again. And I feel like if you hate the shows where, or not hate the shows where we do this, but I mean, this is important. But I mean, like, well, if you don't like these reports, I get it. But the way to make them go away is to make the problem go away. And reading the report and putting it down, telling people not to click links and hope that they'll listen to you, tell people they need to patch and hope they do it, it's just not working. They're still not doing it. And I think this report is really putting that into light.
I mean, at the end of the day, people don't really believe these things will happen to them. And we have the numbers to back that up on our own TaxCare report that we talked about a few months back. And we have on our website, if you want to pick it up, we have a report that's similar in goal to this one from Verizon. And we ask people, and until the moment where they experience this for themselves in their own organization and they see the problem that it brings, they don't really understand why they need to patch fast enough, why they need to patch faster than a month, and why that's important. But when they suffer a breach, when an incident happens, when they see the cost, if not financial, then the work that's required to bring everything back in working order again. Until that happens, and they just don't feel the pain and they don't feel it as something possible. And that's really sad, to, for lack of a better word, because you could have avoided the problem if you had taken action previously, if you had acted before rather than reacting to the problem. And yeah, it's a pity that we're still falling for this type of problems. Again, these numbers on the report, on the Verizon report, after 1 year, 8% of the vulnerabilities are still unpatched. This wasn't acceptable 10 years ago. If you had a vulnerability, a non-vulnerability unpatched after 1 year, you knew you had problems already. There were already the expectation of somebody else being inside of your server, not just you. Today, it's almost untenable to run an infrastructure like this. At the pace with which you get new vulnerabilities, at the pace with which you get new patches that you need to deploy, and which you have problems, serious problems, if you don't patch, holding out for an entire year.
Yeah, that's really, there's just no way to justify that, no matter what. I mean, that's just ridiculous. That's a long time. I patch things. I mean, I can't wait to patch things. Like, oh my God, let me get that patch. But we need to, I mean, I understand people are sometimes nervous too, because sometimes things go wrong, but I'd rather have a server not boot than a company close.
The last thing that I would like to touch on that they also refer in the Verizon report is what was actually targeted inside of the of an organization. And the top three things are web applications. Those are the things that are facing the outside, where you can find bugs in the HTML, find bugs in the backend, the works. Hackers love these things. Email systems, and we know even Microsoft fell for this. And carelessness. This last one is great. They have a category for carelessness. It includes stuff like not patching your systems. And these are the top three things that malicious actors are going for when they're trying to hack an organization. These are the things that they will definitely attack. These are the things that we know have been used on existing incidents. So, yeah. Carelessness is way too high on that list.
So does carelessness include when somebody accidentally drops their MacBook down the stairs or something? Just curious.
Yeah, I don't
really
know.
Where they draw that line. Because some of the other things on here make me think that there might be some other things in those numbers too, but you never know. But that's carelessness.
Okay, so the report is 100 pages monster, so take your time, go through it. There's lots of interesting tidbits. Quick note, the way that it's written, the tone that they use throughout the report, it's really humorous, it's really funny to read, it's very interesting. Kudos to the guys that wrote it. Kelly's article is really good as well. It's smaller than the 100 pages of the report, but it has some interesting tidbits and analysis as well. And do take the time to go over them. Interesting readings all around. And yeah, thank you very much for joining, and until the next one.